We will start with a meditation. So, just inviting you to get comfortable and find your way to a seat. I like keeping it on gallery view because I will probably, you may have your eyes closed, but if you open, you'll see that there's, 75 people or so around the world meditating with you. So just the invitation is to settle back into a posture that is comfortable, whether it is on a chair or floor or bed or couch or wherever you are that is comfortable and supportive and useful for your practice. This now. Taking a few deeper, longer, slower breaths. To get started. And with each breath, inviting in a little bit more peace, ease, rest. If that doesn't seem possible, then the possibility of peace, relaxation, ease. And sensing into your body here and now, bringing your attention to your feet, and your feet can be on the floor if you're in a chair, maybe you're cross-legged. So feet on the floor, hands resting where they're comfortable, back upright, but not too rigid or tight. Eyes can be closed. And some people don't want to meditate with their eyes closed. It's fine to leave them open. I recommend looking downward so you don't get too distracted. And there may be some of us with physical pain. And so it's also fine to meditate lying down. And if you're doing that, the risk is falling asleep. But if you're awake enough, it's also a fine posture to meditate in. So, bringing your attention to your feet or whatever is the closest to the ground. So, it might be your feet, it might be the base of your body, it might be your whole body if you're lying down. And just have a sense of, like, I am supported here by the earth, by the ground. Letting yourself sink in, sink your weight, drop your weight into whatever it is that is holding you up. You might, as you're on the chair, just noticing your legs on the chair, your feet on the ground. Taking some deeper breaths as we settle into the support. And you might, if you want to, imagine the earth beneath your feet. So your body is being held by the earth. And the earth supports us going deep, deep down. It nurtures the plants and animals. It supports life. And then gently notice your body. Notice if there are areas of tension or tightness. And if you encounter them, you can bring a little softening, taking a deeper breath, such as noticing your belly, is it tense, letting it soften. Notice your hands. You might notice tingling and warmth, coolness. Let them soften. Notice your arms and shoulders, dropping your shoulders. Sometimes when I notice my shoulders or my neck area, I start to think, oh, it'd be really nice to just rotate my head a little bit and move my shoulders. So I'm going to do that right now. And if you want to do that, you can do it mindfully. It's like, oh, it feels so good just to tilt my head to one side to the other, breathing. Helping us come into our bodies to be present here and now. Let your face be soft. Can come back to stillness, letting your face be soft, facial muscles soften. That awareness of your whole body present here. So much happening in the body, usually just noticing the aliveness in this human body. And now let's turn our attention to the sounds that are happening around us. Maybe there's sounds in the room or outside the room. Listening to sounds as if you're listening to your favorite music. Curious, open. Sounds are coming and going. Ambient sounds, the ambient noise, or there might be like an abrupt sound, or there might be what feels like a lot of silence. You can notice that. Not lost in a story, just noticing. Notice if listening to sounds feels soothing to you, helpful, peaceful, interesting. It may or may not. It may actually be the opposite. It might be, agitating and annoying, or it might be neutral to you. And just to notice what the impact of doing a listening meditation is. It's always a good alternative, that listening meditation, when it's hard to be with our breathing, if you're ever in that situation. Or if you're feeling really tense and tight, you might open up to the spaciousness of sound coming and going. And then letting go of that for the time being, come back to your body, to your breath. Finding your breath. Might notice the rising and falling of your abdomen. The expanding and settling of your chest. Rising, settling, or rising, falling. Or maybe you notice the air moving through your nose, tingling, warmth, coolness. So, where do you pay attention? What's your main focus? Sometimes called the anchor, or your home base in meditation. For most people, it's, the breath in one of those areas that I mentioned. There are some people who do full body breathing, like noticing the breath going up and down through the torso. It's another option. And there are some people who don't do the breath at all, but they use sounds as their anchor, their home base. If you know what you normally do, just go to it, unless you want to try something different today, just for fun. Maybe normally you pay attention to your breathing. But today you want to try listening. It's really your choice. If you're new and you're not certain, just pick one of them. They all work equally well. Choose whichever is the clearest or easiest. So we can start with breath after breath, or sound after sound. One breath ends, the next begins. As you do this, What typically happens for people is they start to think about other things, wander, imagine, plan, remember, and so on. This is normal. I know you know this. Just a reminder, this is normal. That's what minds do. When you notice your attention has wandered, you can say a soft word in your mind, like thinking or wandering, and then return your attention back to your focus. And then you can just keep doing that over and over. And that's the basic form of this practice. Keeping in mind that there are other ways to practice, but if you're just starting out, it's a good place to start. Feel your breath. When you get lost in thought, notice it thinking. Then bring your attention back to that spot. You're noticing your breath or the listening. But for people with more experience, you know that. So there's other ways to practice. And so another way is when your attention gets pulled away, you can really notice what pulls you away. Stay with it, feel it, sense it, notice it. And then when it's no longer really grabbing your attention, you can go back to your breathing or your home base. So you might be with your breathing and then you start to have a strong body sensation. And you bring your attention to it and you feel it and you notice that it expands and it grows, it gets a little stronger, intensifies, and you stay with it with awareness. And then maybe it shifts and gets softer, or then you lose your focus or it just ends. So you can come back to your main object, back to the breath. So we can move into different experiences. And then sometimes we might find that there's really no home base. There's no anchor. Like we didn't notice there's body sensation, and then there's a sound, and then there's breath, and then there's a memory, and then there's some of sadness, and then that sadness grows, and then you feel heat, and then you notice an itch, and then, and so on. So this is what we would call like a choiceless awareness or open awareness practice. That may happen too. There's lots of ways, lots and lots of ways to do this practice. So I just invite you to explore and see what happens. Okay, I'll be quiet for the next part. As we get to the end of the meditation, I just want to invite you to ask yourself a question. And that question will get at sort of your personal motivation for practicing, for meditating, practicing the Dharma, learning, studying, and practicing. So the question is why? Like, what is my motivation for practice? And just see what emerges from within you. There's no right or wrong. It could just be to reduce stress, to help me with my anxiety, to help me be a better human. I mean, anything. But I'm curious, as we ask that question for ourselves, what emerges? Why do I practice? What's my motivation? And as you state that motivation, notice how you feel inside. What's the impact on you of recognizing it and acknowledging it? And just to notice what's here inside you. And now let's feel our feet on the ground or something concrete, obvious. Take a breath. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes or end the meditation. Okay, coming back into the room. Just getting reoriented here. Before I start my talk, I would love if you would put into the chat anyone who wants to share why they practice, what their motivation is. To be in reality without distraction, because it feels deeply sane. It's my rendezvous with the holy, dropping into peace. It helps me feel better than if I didn't, to come back to myself and make space, to feel at ease in family situations, clarity of heart and mind, to be more at peace, to end suffering. Stress relief, brain health, being a better person. These are all, by the way, fantastic. I mean, all of these motivations are so wonderful. Four Noble Truths. And they're all different, if you notice, right? Leading to nibbana, to awakening, to remember wholeness. I practice to make my mind peaceful, to bring peace to my life. I like to find a little space in between my thoughts to be more at peace, better person, achieved equanimity. To connect to something bigger than myself, time out, and on it goes. So you can take a look at the chat because there's just beautiful, beautiful motivations. To grow in wisdom so as to suffer less for my own benefit and that of others. Okay, that's a great lead in to my talk. All of these are beautiful. And this is a lead in to my talk because I'm going to talk about the bodhisattva and what that means. And that's intricately, intimately connected to our motivation for practice. So I'll get started. First of all, I want to say that I love the concept of the bodhisattva. It's always been something that's been very profound for me. And when I first heard it, when I started practicing, like in the late 80s, I was just like, oh, bodhisattva, that makes sense. It just, the concept seems so like aligned with my own inner longings and values. So it's we can think of it as a being that's dedicated to waking up for the sake of all beings. A being that's dedicated to cultivating their own wisdom and compassion, keeping in mind the whole world and all of the suffering in the world, and to have more wisdom and compassion to wake up for themselves and to help everybody else wake up. And that's, you know, a very loose definition. I'm going to talk about different definitions and so on, but that's the way that I tend to understand it. And it's an incredible archetype, and it's also a living vision and a commitment that one can take on. It doesn't have to be this thing that's like, oh, only some like, you know, like very high spiritual person can attain to be a bodhisattva. It's actually, I think, something very accessible to all of us when we look at it in a way that is meaningful for each of us. So the word bodhi just means awake, and sattva being. So clearly that means awakened being. And if you look at in Buddhism, historically, all schools of Buddhism carry an aspiration to have oh, to for awakening, right? And in some schools, it's kind of thought of as to become a Buddha, right? And that's the deepest aspiration pot. So the Buddha, by the way, Buddha just means awakened being, right? He was called the Buddha. His name was Siddhartha Gautama, right? But he was the but Buddha means the awakened one. So that's the deepest aspiration possible. And in like, you know, in ancient Buddhism, and really in all forms of Buddhism. And I mostly teach secularly. So when I come to the Southwest Sangha, I can Southwest, sorry, Sangha Live. Sorry, I don't know why I called it. That was weird. I'm going to draw more on Buddhist teachings than for those of you, because I see a lot of students that have come to my classes in more secular context, but I'm going to be bringing in the Buddhism. So it's an aspiration. So historically, all of the schools of Buddhism have this aspiration, and for beings to be free from samsara. Samsara is the cycle of birth and life and death and rebirth, right? So there's, you know, a cosmology involved there. And it's the word bodhisattva is sometimes used to mean like almost like a pantheon of gods. Right, so if any of you studied in Tibetan Buddhism, you'll see this bodhisattva, that bodhisattva. So, for example, Avalokiteshvara with the thousand arms, Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin. So, most of you have probably heard of Kuan Yin. She's the bodhisattva of compassion. That so Avalokiteshvara is also a bodhisattva of compassion. Kuan Yin is comes to us more from, I think, from Chinese Buddhism, and she's often translated as she who hears the cries of the world. So there's all these different like archetypal versions of bodhisattvas. And so this is where it can get confusing, because if we're thinking, oh, the bodhisattva ideal is about these like mystical, magical beings that I would never have any access to, then we can get stuck. But there's other ways of thinking about it. Now, some of the teachings around the bodhisattva that you hear about is that it's someone who sticks around and doesn't get enlightened until every single being in the cosmos is enlightened. So this one is a very like weird understanding in my view, because first of all, it depends on a belief in past and future lives. And I mean, obviously, I don't mean to, it's something that people believe wholeheartedly, but it doesn't really make sense logically if you think about it, because if you're sticking around till every single being is enlightened, are you all going like, no, after you, no, after, because what if other people are bodhisattvas and they're all going after you, and then like, does anything ever happen? And also, does that mean like every single bug, like the millions and jillions and zillions of bugs, right? Are we like, so that is a bit of an incomprehensible way of understanding it, but it is in some forms of Buddhism that is one of the ways it's looked at, or you've probably heard that, like, I'm gonna postpone my enlightenment until everybody else is enlightened. But then other forms of Buddhism say the bodhisattva is like a fuel to the fire to help us to get enlightened really fast. That when you take the bodhisattva bodhisattva vow, it's like a lighting a fire, and boom, it leads to a quicker enlightenment. So there's lots of ways of looking at it, and I just want to, and I want to even take it apart a little bit more so we can look at some of the other ways, and then I'll tell you kind of my way of looking at it, which I think anyway touches me and is meaningful in that way. So one of the great texts that is about the Bodhisattva is by someone named Shantideva, who lived in the 7th century and wrote a book called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And you can There's many translations. I think even like Pema Chodron did this very long sort of analysis of it. There's a lot of text, but here's some of your sense to get a sense of what the Bodhisattva is in relation to all beings. And here's a quote: "May I become at all times, both now and forever, a protector for those without protection, a guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with oceans to cross, a bridge for those with rivers to cross, a sanctuary for those in danger, a lamp for those without light, a place of refuge for those who lack shelter, and a servant to all in need." So you're getting a sense of this aspiration. I'll talk about the aspiration in a moment, but this like this being who is this like servant of all beings, servant to awakening and to everybody's awakening. And it's like this just I find that to be like so moving and so beautiful. Now, so there are in currently in Buddhist countries, there will be people will say that's a bodhisattva. That person is a bodhisattva. So there was a Burmese teacher, in Burmese Buddhism is Theravadan Buddhism. Theravadan Buddhism doesn't traditionally have the bodhisattva concept, but yet in our lifetime, and certainly my lifetime, there's been different Burmese masters who've identified themselves as bodhisattvas, which is like, wait, I don't get it because I thought it's not supposed to be Bodhisattva in Theravada Buddhism, but anyway, it is in there. It's not, I think people think Mahayana Buddhism has a Bodhisattva, Theravada doesn't, and Theravada is the Arhat. So I just want to clarify this, because the idea is like the Arhat is the person who's going to get enlightened and just escape the cycle of birth and rebirth, samsara. But it's actually not that way. It's much more complex and nuanced. So just to name that. Now, the idea is there, another idea is that there are bodhisattvas walking among us, and that they're like when you look at great people in the world, like Gandhi or the Dalai Lama or Martin Luther King Jr., or all these people, you can say that person is a bodhisattva. And it's one nice way to think about them. Like there are these bodhisattvas emerging, not knowing themselves to be bodhisattvas. Well, the Dalai Lama is not a good example because it is in his lineage, but like Gandhi never maybe thought about bodhisattva, right, being a bodhisattva, but we can see them that way. And they're walking among us, and they're all throughout history and space and time, and all these forces of good are these bodhisattvas. I this year have experienced the loss of three different bodhisattvas in my life. Three Buddhist, well, actually four in some ways, Buddhist teachers who died this year who were great. We can think of them as bodhisattvas. Like so many of you are probably familiar with Joanna Macy, who just died a few months ago. And she's this was this incredible bodhisattva heart, this eco-philosopher with such amazing writings and teachings and helping us to navigate this crazy time that we live in. And another person, I'll just mention them because this is meaningful to me, was Alan Sanaki. Alan Sanaki was the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center, and he had this enormous bodhisattva heart, and he went out and he did all this international peace and justice work in Buddhist countries, especially in Burma, Myanmar, and with the Untouchables in India. And then Larry Ward, who I didn't know that well, but it was a wonderful teacher in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. He died this year. And then another person who not a, in a Buddhist at all, I just the person who was the head of the psychiatric institute at UCLA, who was my like the person who was the head of the psychiatric institute that I was part of for many years, was this visionary in mental health and built some of the first autism centers for research. He was the one who brought mindfulness. He let us come in and bring mindfulness into the psychiatry department, so much so that it's like embedded and there's been institutional changes. And he was this extraordinary visionary around mental health. So these are the bodhisattvas of our times, right? They're all these bodhisattvas, but even that might be too much. Like you're hearing this and you're thinking, oh, not me. I'm not that kind of person. I think the bodhisattva vision and the bodhisattva heart can be held by anyone. And what we do with it and how it manifests doesn't have to be this huge deal. I'm mentioning them, one, because it's been a, it's been something important to me this year, but also, I think you get it when I mention the these incredible people who are doing this work, but it could also be ordinary people, people we don't even know, people we don't, people who are just generous of heart. And this is a beautiful poem by an author called a poet called Laura Fargus. It's called Kuan Yin. So remember Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion. And she's kind of bringing it into like the ordinary life. Of the many Buddhas, I love best the girl who will not leave the cycle of pain before anyone else. She's at the brink of never being hurt again, but pauses to say, all of us, every blade of grass. She chooses to live in the tumble of souls through time. Perhaps she sees spring in every country, talks quietly with farm women while helping to lay seed. Our hearts are a storm she trembles at. I picture her leaning on a tree or humming or joining a volleyball game on Santa Monica Beach. Her skin shines with sweat. The others may not know how to notice what she does to them. She's not a fish or a bee. It is not pity or thirst. She could go, but here she is. And I think this poem, when I read it many years ago, it's probably 20 years old, it just spoke to that part of like the magical bodhisattvas that are probably walking around that we just don't even know, who are doing all these acts of generosity. And it could be us, right? It absolutely could be us. So to me, what is the bodhisattva then? It's the bodhisattva heart. And we'll talk about that, the motivation, but it's this expression of our deepest aspirations. And the deepest aspirations are to wake up, to wake up, to wake up from our sense of separation, from our separate self that thinks we're so important, that feels so isolated and alone, that's lost in our dramas and our neuroses and all of the like me stuff, to wake up from that and to gain freedom from that and to do it in the context of everybody else, to live with wisdom and compassion, to end our own suffering and awaken with all beings, and to live a fearless and committed life. This is the bodhisattva. This is the bodhisattva path in my view. So there's a lot of, like I said, there's like Buddhist theology around it and ideas, and this lineage says this and this, but I think the spirit of it is easily captured and understood as this being, just going back to the very beginning, who wants to develop wisdom and compassion for the sake of all beings, and that includes themselves too. So one of the ways that the bodhisattva becomes the bodhisattva is by taking vows. And vows are really interesting and important because they can be, when we get clearer about our motivation, that's why I asked you to do that in the very beginning, we can see ourselves more clearly and make better decisions. And when we understand the intentions behind an action. There's a famous Tibetan quote, I forget which teacher said it, but it was, everything rests on the tip of motivation. And so it's a process of self-understanding to begin to look at our motivations and then maybe take vows. And it also, when we make a commitment, it becomes a North Star for us. So that when we get lost, we can always, we get off track, like here, oops, wait, here's our North Star, we get off track. And then, oh, we remind us of our commitments, and then we can turn in the direction, and then maybe we get lost again, and then we turn around, right? And so it's guidance for our inner compass, really. Now, in the concept of the bodhisattva is a word called bodhicitta, and bodhicitta means, bodhi again, awaken, but chitta, the word means heart or mind. So I think you've probably heard this many times, but in some cultures, mind is here, in some cultures, mind is here. And so that's why we translate chitta as heart mind. So the heart mind or the is a limitless heart mind. This bodhicitta is the motivation for awakening. I have this bodhicitta that's limitless, like the sky, that has a vision of awakening, this heart mind of awakening. And it's this aspiration for awakening. And also there's with a bodhisattva, there's also engagement. So it is this, the heart wants to wake up. It feels the motivation. It's this, okay, I can break free from my own delusion into something greater, and I can act from it. So it's very famously Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master, was said, compassion is a verb, right? Compassion is just not just only a feeling, but it's also a doing. So with the bodhisattva heart, we can have this intention. And remember that intention. I was reading what Shantideva said: may I be at all times a protector for those without protection, a guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with oceans to cross. You know, I say those words and I sometimes get chills. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like to have that. Now I know there's a lot of obstacles. There are several of you sitting here thinking, like, are you kidding? Who, me? No way. Right. And that's pretty normal because it can feel like grandiose, like, oh, having a bodhisattva intention. Well, I'm just an ordinary person. Who am I to do that? And one of the things that I like us to say is like, who are you not to do that, right? Like to me, it's not about, I'm obviously not, I have taken bodhisattva commitments personally, and I've offered them to students, and it's been something very important to me. It's not grandiose, like now I've taken bodhisattva vows, so I'm gonna like save the whole world. It's nothing like that. It just means that my heart, there's an awakening in my heart to care profoundly for others, and that my practice is not for me alone. It is to help wake up with all beings and to serve in that way. So if you're sitting here thinking this is very grandiose, maybe just kind of get out of that mind state a little bit. And by the way, I'm not giving this talk to try to convince you to become a bodhisattva and what I call an ordinary bodhisattva. I'm definitely not doing that. I'm doing it because I love the theme and I think it's an interesting possibility. So how do people become bodhisattvas? Well, what's interesting in different schools of Buddhism, it's done in different ways. So if you go to a Soto Zen temple, and there are different forms of Zen, but Soto Zen is very familiar here in the US. There's a lot of Soto Zen temples. You chant with everybody. You walk into the temple and you chant, and it's one of the first thing you do, and you do a bodhisattva chant. So it's kind of embedded in the culture and the teachings, and it's not even really thought of as that big of a deal, although it is an incredibly big deal. So let me read you the Soto Zen Bodhisattva chant. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. What the heck, right? It's a chant of impossibilities. And in some way, that's kind of the point. It's to open the heart and the mind to the possibility of like in and of itself, it's a kind of koan, right? Or a puzzle. It's like beings are numberless, so I vow to save all of them. If they're numberless, how can I save them all? Delusions are inexhaustible. Delusions are inexhaustible, but I'm going to end them. So it's not literal. It's not like you're actually doing that. It's more like this is the North Star. You putting this into your consciousness and you're moving in that direction, and then it becomes a guide of for your life, because you'll know like, oh, am I making this choice? Is that aligned with my bodhisattva commitments? Not so much. Oh, this really is. And so it's a practice. I mean, I guess that's the simplest way of talking about it, is a practice. Now, in other lineages of Buddhism, they'll do it in a special ceremony. So you can take a bodhisattva vow, like in the Tibetan context, and then there's very strict agreements around it. You have to do these practices, you have to commit to this. So that's done in other lineages. I like the concept of the ordinary bodhisattva, because I feel like that ordinary bodhisattva is an an archetype for our times. And it's an incredible example of how we can be a living bodhisattva, just an ordinary person dedicated to waking up with the consciousness of all of the humans that we are intimately connected with, that we are not separate. One of my earliest Buddhist experiences was when I was just starting out. I think this was like right in the very beginning, and I was doing a meditation retreat in Dharamsala, India. And there were about 40 of us on this retreat, and we got to meet with the Dalai Lama. And this was back before he was a rock star, before you're like in stadiums with 30,000 people. There were 40 of us in this room, and we had to give a question to him in advance. And so I was a very activist person. I was really into political activism. So I sent this. I was just like right out of college, and I sent, and my question was, can you please talk about the intersection of politics and meditation practice and Buddhism or Dharma? Basically, I think that was, it was something like that. And anyway, they had to translate it to him, translate it. And by the time it got to him, the question was, can politicians meditate? I was like, that wasn't my question, but okay. And so I remember him. And we were in the small room, and I was very close to him. And he did hit one of his laughs, and he said, "Of course, politicians can meditate." And then he got the real question, and then he said these three words that have been like, well, I'll just tell you what the three words are. He said, "Please know that Dharma is service." Dharma is service. And those words have been like they've been a guidepost for me my whole life as a practitioner, that there is no separation between my spiritual practice and the service I do in the world, that it is all intimately connected, and that I serve my, as I serve, hopefully it helps me awaken more. And as I get more awakened, I can serve more. That it's like that it's right, and it's a process, right? I'm just an ordinary practitioner, but I hold this extraordinary motivation because it uplifts me. There's so much joy as I practice in this way, and it's so meaningful. It's not meaningful for everybody. I'll tell you, my husband, he's like, "Oh no, I'm not a bodhisattva." Which I think is totally wrong. I'm always telling him, "Of course you are. Look at how he does great work in the world." And he's like, no, I can't take that on. It's just too heavy." And I'm like, okay. So I just want to give you a lot of space here, as I'm very enthusiastic about this, and I might get a little too excited. So just know I'm not here to convince anybody of anything. I can't even convince my own husband. So there you go. Let's see. So that Dalai Lama quote really motivated me, and I then decided on my own to make it part of my practice. And so when I meditate, And honestly, because we're in a living tradition, I think it's really important that we make it our own, that we don't just like, here's the doctrinal way of doing something, but how do we make it real and alive and make it our own? So in my morning meditation, I will say some different lines from really from Shantideva. So I'll tell you what I say. I'd say, and I don't do it every day because I don't know, sometimes I forget or whatever, but I'll say, for as long as space, this is Shantideva, this is a interpretation of like a not a direct translation, but I like it. For as long as space exists, try again. For as long as space exists and sentient beings endure, may I be the living ground of love for all beings. And sometimes I say a different version, for as long as space exists and sentient beings endure, may I stay to dispel the misery of the world. That one's a little heavier, so I kind of like the other one better. But that's been something I've said for 35 years. Not every day, but a lot. And it's my North Star. I just go, oh, okay, that's what's guiding me. May I be a living ground of love for all beings. I encourage another thing I'll say about it is I've done ceremonies around it. I've done in ceremonies myself. I've done ceremonies with different teachers. I also had a very meaningful moment when I was under the Bodhi tree in India, and I just stated that vow over and over, and also said some of the stuff from Shantideva. May I be a boat, may I be a ocean, may I be, all of these things. And I remember it just being a profound commitment, and how incredible to do it under the Bodhi tree in India. Maybe some of you have visited there. And now, because I see it as a living tradition, we need to, if we're taking something like this on, we can make it our own. We can do it in however we want, what I love is that there's a constantly evolving living relationship to it. So it might be something you kind of have a tentative interest in and you're going to explore. It might be something you go, no, not for me. It might be something that you're like, oh, I want to work with this, and I'll work with it every day. And how will I do it? I will say some commitment in the morning, or I'll reflect on my motivation, or when I'm making decisions, I'll think about it, or I'll have gratitude for my life and look at, and you can go back and look at your life and look at all the places that your life has already been a place of service and connection and care for the world. And it's really comes down to, is this helpful for you? Does it inspire your heart? Does it impact your practice? And if it does, great. And if it doesn't, don't worry about it. And it doesn't have to be even like your version. I've done over the years, I've had people write Bodhisattva vows and stuff, and they don't have to have this major, like, save all beings kind of Bodhisattva vow. It can be something simpler, like to be more truthful and loving, to live a life of kindness, to be more open-hearted and less quick to anger, right? There can be versions of it that are just real to you, and that is great. Like, that for me is just as important and relevant. Okay, so the last thing I want to do is read a quote about the Bodhisattva vow from Sangharakshita, who I know is a controversial figure, but I love his writing on this here. Sangharakshita was a teacher in the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order and an author. Okay, so here's what he says. Although it is traditional to speak of the Bodhisattva's vow, the vow is generally a set of vows which varies from one Bodhisattva to another, reflecting their special interests and aptitudes within the wider context of the Bodhisattva ideal. If we take the image of light refracted through a glass prism, the bodhicitta, the awakened heart and mind, and the motivation, is like pure white light shining through the prism, which represents the bodhisattva. So just get a sense of that. the image of light reflected through a glass prism. The bodhicitta is like the light shining through the prism, which is the bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva's vows are like the colors of the rainbow emerging on the other side. To take this simile further, we could say that the pure white light of the relative bodhicitta streams from the sun of the absolute bodhicitta and shines through hundreds and thousands of individual prisms, so that each produces its own combination of colors. Within the spectrum usually visible to us, the rainbow only has seven colors. But some kind of meditation involves trying to imagine, visualize, or see other colors, colors one has never seen before. We can think of all these prisms as emitting not just seven colors that we know, but hundreds and thousands of wonderful new colors. And similarly, we can imagine the bodhicitta shining through the minds and hearts of different bodhisattvas, producing innumerable combination of vows. So this quote's kind of long, but I think what he's getting at is imagine colors that don't exist. Imagine your expression of bodhicitta that we don't even know what it is, that there can be innumerable, countless expressions of bodhicitta. And I'll never forget when a colleague of mine years ago said, I couldn't imagine taking on the bodhisattva vow initially because I thought, that's heavy, man. That's a lot to take on. And then he said, and then one day I realized, wait a minute, I wasn't the only one. There were also countless beings taking this on, and that we were all doing this together. And then it felt like the load was a lot lighter. So I'm going to stop here and just see where you are with everything I've been saying. So I'm going to open it up for questions. And before I do that, let me just make a little and comments. Let me just make a little plug here for, what did I call it? Selfless earlier. Anyway, for Sangha Live. As Caroline mentioned, this is such a beautiful offering. They've been doing this for I don't know how long, like a decade at least. Is that right, Caroline? A long time. Yeah. And they've been doing it only through generosity. I mean, this is wild. People give to this organization because they know that they can come and receive these beautiful teachings. Hundreds of teachers. They've really, I think, helped launch the careers of some teachers. They have been this incredible international resource for the Dharma for, a very long time. And so your generosity keeps the organization going, supports the teachers, it supports the free-flowing Dharma as we get to experience it. So I just want to encourage you to make a donation, and we just put in the link there. All right. So someone asks in the comments, any readings you'd recommend on this? Yes. I mean, you can read Sangharakshita's book called The Bodhisattva Ideal. It's kind of dense, but it's good. But there's a lot in it. There's Pema Chodron did a whole commentary on Shantideva. I haven't. Let me think more about particular ones. You can also contact me offline, and if people are interested, and I'll see what I think is. I don't know what the latest in books are around it right now. So I saw someone had their hand up, but then they disappeared.
Yeah, that was me. Diana, thank you for this talk. It really helped clarify some things for me, and I've been sort of struggling with this on and off myself for the recent past, and it sort of reminds me of your friend or husband or whoever it was who said, I can't take this vow because it's too much. And I that's kind of where I was at. Just as a side note, a little story. I was in a museum with a good friend of mine. I love the guy, and I'm pretty sure we were in the Asian art section looking at all the Buddhas and whatnot. And we were with our respective spouses, and all of a sudden he said, "Oh, I've come to real I've been told that I'm a bodhisattva, and this was I just looked at him, and all I could think, the only thing that popped out of my mouth was, "How do you know?" And I just thought it was funny because I didn't mean it in a mean way. I didn't even think about it. It just came out of my mouth. It was just kind of funny.
It is a good question. How do you know? So just to say a couple of things in response. I appreciate your, kind of honest approach to it. The Bodhi, I mean, we can have this very highly developed or highly like, what is the word? Just like idealized version of the Bodhisattva. And I think for anybody in a way, that's too much, But to be a person who's practicing, who's keeping in awareness all beings, who's trying to develop wisdom and compassion, like that's more down to earth and doable. And that's why I said when I sometimes do these ceremonies with the Bodhisattva vows, I ask people to create their own and have them be really real and authentic, something that feels doable, that doesn't feel out of the range. So that's just something for you to consider as you're thinking about it. Anyway, for you to think about. So I'm getting people are requesting some the readings and the readings that I read today. We'll get them all up on the website. And anyway, Phil, I hope that's helpful just to know that it doesn't have to be that big of a deal. And that it's evolving. It's evolving. And I'll tell you, my husband is incredibly generous and kind and has a life devoted to service in the work that he does in the world. But for him, he just gets intimidated by that. He goes, no. And I really, really respect that. And I feel like that's absolutely fine. I mean, it's perfect for what he wants and who he is. But I secretly think he's a bodhisattva. I hope he's not on today. And know that I'm like talking about him secretly. He probably wouldn't like that. Okay. Could I go back and review the concept of bodhicitta? It's spelled, let me just write how it's spelled. Bodhicitta. It's spelled like that. Bodhicitta is the motivation. So there's a bodhisattva, and then the bodhisattva has a motivation called bodhicitta. And the bodhi that so it's the awakened heart. It's the like internal workings of the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is the being. The bodhicitta is what is in their heart. I guess that's a way of talking about it. And bodhi means awakened, citta means heart, mind. So it's that aspiration. The bodhicitta is the aspiration of for awakening. Oh, someone gave a suggestion for a good book. Oh, great. Reflections on Silver River, 27, oh, 37 verses on the practice of the Bodhisattva by Ken MacLeod. Great. Does Buddhist wisdom make any reference to people being of the devil or evil? It's such an interesting question. They will talk about people like deluded minds, ignorant minds, aversive minds, greedy minds, that people have that capacity within them to be so deluded that they're disconnected from the opposite of those things, from their goodness, from their loving kindness, from their wisdom and clarity and clear seeing. Now, in so that's one way of thinking about it, right? That like a person is not inherently evil from a Buddhist perspective, but it is, so clouded over and obscured, they cannot access their goodness. However, there is in more in like Buddhist, what do you call it? Like folklore, the concept of Mara, and Mara is like the Buddhist devil, sort of. Mara is the forces of evil and delusion. And like in, if you know the story of the Buddha's life, Mara, when the Buddha's sitting under the Bodhi tree trying to get enlightened, or he doesn't know that, but whatever, something's happening, the forces of Mara come to stop him. So it's kind of like the Buddhist devil comes to stop him, and they send him beautiful women. I guess he's it's heteronormative, whatever. They send him armies of ignorance to fight him. They send him greed and hate. They send him all these like they're kind of like more archetypes of the, oh, I'm trying to say, of the feelings themselves. And the Buddha kind of fights them all and gets rid of them all and then is able to wake up. So it does exist in a more folklorish way. And there were some like nasty people in the early writings of the Buddha, but the Buddha usually turned them around. There's the wonderful story of Angulimala. Do y'all know the story of Angulimala? No? Okay, I'll tell it quickly because it's just a really fun story. It's just talking about can people change? Angulimala was a bad guy, like a really, really bad guy alive at the time of the Buddha. And his name, Angulimala, means necklace, mala, a necklace of fingers, anguli, fingers. And it was, and he had 100 or 1,000 of these fingers around his neck from all the people he killed. So he was a bandit and a robber and a killer and a murderer, blah, blah, blah. So, the Buddha saw with his infinite wisdom, his ability, his like psychic powers, that the Angulimala was about to kill his own parent. And in traditional Buddhist literature, like that is bad news. Do not kill your parent. So the Buddha went to stop him. And the way he did it was he came in front of Angulimala, and Angulimala, instead of going to kill his mother or father, turns and starts to try to kill the Buddha. And with the Buddha's magical powers, he's going ahead of Angulimala. No matter how far he goes, he couldn't get him. And then finally Angulimala shouts, "Stop," to the Buddha, and the Buddha replies, "I have stopped. Now you stop," meaning stop the cycle of suffering, stopped the ignorance, stopped the greed, hatred, and delusion. And apparently at that moment, this evil, horrible murderer transformed and became a disciple of the Buddha and became enlightened. I just told you that story just because you're asking about evilness in Buddhist concepts. But he did have to pay karmic consequences because apparently anytime he went into a village, people would throw things at him. So I don't know. And he just dealt with it at that point. Okay. How does the concept of bodhisattva fit with the Zulu Ubuntu Sawubona? I don't actually know anything about it, so I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I believe that citta comes from the same word as chit in Satchitananda. I'm not sh possibly because Sanskrit and Pali are so close, so it may very well be the case. Any other comments, questions, thoughts about all this? Bartek.
Hi, Diana.
Hey.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the talk. Yeah, you touched on something that I found interesting, and I'd like to maybe talk to you about that and hear what you can say about. So see, you said the Arahants, right? From Theravada. They're the one who fully cook, and they're the one who can be trusted. So that means if anyone can be a bodhisattva and take the vows, right? So can we trust those bodhisattvas? I know the motivations can be good, but they can be still deluded. The advice, they might not be, what we maybe need at that time. It's not like the Arahants, which they probably from their own experience, they will know. What we're doing wrong. So what you can say about that, about trusting in bodhisattvas, and who will trying to guide us in this world, because it's a beautiful motivation. And I think, the Arahants, they have nothing left. They know they can only be bodhisattvas because there is no self, because they're become like selfless. They can only, do stuff with other people because they know there's not much there except, people who are confused, deluded. So can you say something about this, bodhisattvas and trust we can, who can be trusted, and how we can even, who can be listened to.
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting question. And I would say a couple of things because there's traditional Buddhist philosophy, and then there's like sort of lived experience. And like, yes, an arhat is the highest in Theravada Buddhism, and it's and the it's a big way in which Theravada separates itself from Mahayana Buddhism by saying we are going on the arhat path versus you guys are going on the bodhisattva path, right? But in so from a Mahayana perspective, they're going to say, no, a bodhisattva has so much wisdom and compassion, right? They know they're it's like kind of the equivalent of the arhat. They're just sticking around. So in fact, they get very like, they get kind of like judgy, like, oh, arhat's bad because they're not willing to stick around. I'm not kidding. There's a lot of infighting in these people, right? We're the true path because we're not selfish. Arhats are selfish. I've heard that countless times in Vajrayana Mahayana context, but nonetheless, when we think about it more from like an ordinary bodhisattva perspective, like we're all a little bit like we don't have full wisdom. We're not arhats. Most of us are not fully woken up. But I would say that a person who's on a bodhisattva path, or at least is committed to wisdom and compassion, is to me feels more trustworthy than just the ordinary person who doesn't care. But I think like you've got to take it with a grain of salt, like who is this person, and their deeds show a lot more than the words in a way. So
Yeah.
does that help? Yeah. It's a really interesting question.
Yeah, kind of. It's interesting because there are people that they don't take those vows, but they're very compassionate, right? They do, like, let's take your
Totally.
husband, like you mentioned, he do a lot of for other people, and where does this come from? It's probably from some past, I don't know, karma.
Yeah.
He find that this nourishing his soul somehow, right? Because when we do something for the others, it just feels good. It doesn't feel bad, that's for sure, right? It just
Yeah.
feels that this is something that's connecting us with another, and it's beautiful. And this way of life, of course, taking the vows, it's being more mindful on everyday basis with, that we motivate that everything we will do, then it'll be just for the other people. Then that helps maybe to break through the illusion, because I was living with the Kadampa tradition before, so I'm kind of familiar with the Tibetan Buddhism also, and we have the another tradition here as well in Scotland, and kind of I understand that living by these vows helps to break through the illusion of this self and me, right? Because then we understand that there is nothing, there, like me, because there are only other people, who needs the help. And sometimes, when we forget ourselves, then we can feel fully and be fully present, and that might be what helps the bodhisattvas to get enlightened quicker, I believe. That's my opinion. Your
Yeah.
second.
No, it's beautiful what you're saying. And I really think what you're speaking to is it doesn't matter if you call it the Bodhisattva, but the people in this world who hold the spirit of care and compassion and service are things that a lot of us really, really admire and value. And that's who I trust. The people who they may not they never even heard of the Bodhisattva, but they represent that spirit. So, yeah.
Beautiful way of life, by the way. So, thank
Yeah.
you for your business.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
You.
Okay. So, let's see. So I see one more hand, and it's a really interesting name, but you know who you are. You look like a little creature with three
Yes,
axolotls.
thank you. Sholopilsil. Thank you. Sorry, I can't be on camera. Yeah, I just it's named after me. It's a new creature I adopted in my heart a year ago.
I'll have to
Sweet.
change my name to Indigenous now. And yeah, I like your talk because it's very helpful today, especially when things feel unsettled with my family situation. I was the one that wrote about my family situation, especially my parents are aging, that they have their testaments in their wheels, and that's where we're at in our family, right? Like all these situations. And I'm like, I tell my siblings, all I want is peace and love. And I could care less about what's stated on the wheels. I don't want to be part of any of it because I'm not into attachment of things like the Buddha practice. I lived with nothing in my life. I lived with lots of things. I lived with nothing has been the best time in my life. And I had things destroyed by fires, and that's it. Like I am not attached to things. Like, and it's so unsettled because I see things one way, they see things the other way. I'm like, fine, just deal with the legal stuff. But honestly, like, this is where I'm at, and it's sad to watch. It's really sad to watch. I try to stay neutral, but it's just. And this afternoon, supposedly, we're supposed to get together with my dad and some of my siblings. But I just feel things feel really yucky,
Well,
it's hard. It's
so
hard.
I hear you. I hear you. And I actually have experience like that where with family situation sounding quite similar, and it's really hard. And I know that feeling of just wanting it to be all just be over and everyone to be in harmony. And it's sometimes it's just a process the family has to walk through. And it sounds like you've dealt with a lot, and you've been sort of shedding and learning to let go. And that's all you can do is just keep nurturing yourself, keep your practice alive, use it in relationship to the family and when you're dealing with people directly. And just, it's usually a long haul with these things, but you will get through it. I know that.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, my parents are still alive. My dad is the one meeting with us, and I've met with him already, and I'm glad he's here to have a say.
That's
But if
great.
they don't have a say, it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
But it's got to be what he says. I mean, his word has to be respected. Whatever's on paper has to be respected. And
Totally.
that's,
Exactly.
but thank you so much for the practice. It really helps feel more at ease. And after this, I'm gonna go walk the dogs at the park. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I'm going to just quickly go through the last questions here. Does the Bodhisattva talk about karmic lessons? I mean, in some ways, I think that's a bigger question than I can answer right now because it's different ways of understanding karma. But just to say that karma is in Buddhist philosophy, karma is pretty embedded in it, in the cycle of birth and life and death and rebirth is all about karma, but I'm not going to get into it much more than that. Will you be teaching a class on this concept? As a possibility, I might. I sometimes teach a class on like a 10-week class on it. And if you just a time to advertise, you could go on to either the UCLA Mindful website or my own website, dianawinston.com. And that's where I announce everything that I'm doing. And maybe I will do something with the Bodhisattva. And I've done it in a way where we get to learn as much as possible and then explore it and explore our relationship and create our own vows and take those vows if you decide you want to. So that is something possible to do. And lastly, someone said, sometimes I feel it can be a little too heavy to be of service. I just want to, but right now it feels overwhelming. I hear you. I hear you. Do not don't try to be something that doesn't feel authentic to you. And if what is important to you right now is nurturing and self-care and compassion for this being, then you stay with that for sure. And it's our life, our practice life is a journey. It's long. There's so much that happens throughout it, and it changes a lot based on external and internal circumstances. So I want to end with just 3-minute meditation, and I'm just gonna put, hold on, let me just let my dog out of the room. He starts scratching when I'm teaching, and then I can't teach because it drives me nuts. Okay.
So I just want to end with a little, you can look, you can find me in all the places that it says, and I'd love to, we do a lot at UCLA Mindful that's free. So you're welcome to join. I have like a Wednesday class that you can drop into. It's myself and other teachers, and you can see what's coming up. And maybe I will do something on the Bodhisattva coming up soon. So just as I said, sign up for my mailing list one way or the other. Okay. All right. So let's end with just a short meditation. And so I just invite you to come into your own body, heart, mind. Take a breath. See where you are. And then just ask the question, having heard about this and just thought and ruminated with it, just even in this little bit of time, what feels next for you around this? Is there something that you want to explore more deeply, understand more fully? And is there any way that your motivation has evolved, even in just thinking about it in this way? Might there be, like, where do you stand with your own bodhisattva motivation or absence of? And notice if there's something else you want to add to your earlier intention. Maybe not. Now let's imagine there all the goodness that came from the class today that we can share it out in the world, far and wide. So may the merit of our practice permeate all things, benefiting all beings everywhere, reducing suffering, increasing happiness, and engendering the awakened heart and mind. Okay, everybody. Thank you.